view to getting somewhere else. So it might be something very, very ordinary, like you suddenly think to yourself, I haven't got any milk. So you say something like, I haven't got any milk. I must go to the shop. So the little piece of communication there starts with something, and then it ends with something. It has a conclusion. It has a purpose, doesn't it? It sort of expresses an intention. I'm going to go to the shop and go and get some milk. What we're reading here is a highly, highly complex and ambitious communication. Some of you perhaps were looking at Barack Obama's farewell address this last week. He made a 40-something minute speech to the nation in which he set out his kind of vision for America going forward. He basically did a 3-point exposition based on the American Declaration of Independence as his text. And in the course of that speech, he had to not touch on a simple matter like going to get a pint of milk, but address the past, the last 10 years of his presidency, 8 years of his presidency, the future, the nature of the Constitution, the different elements and aspects of American society, the global. In other words, it's a highly complex subject. And what we have before us tonight, this book of Deuteronomy, as I've said before, is 3 sermons. This sermon we're looking at, this second sermon, is the most frequently quoted portion of the Old Testament in the New Testament. Because it is the kind of founding address, if I can put it like that, the constituting address of the state of Israel in its ancient and biblical form. He sets out the vision for the state, for the nation, as it's going to be. He takes all the things that have been written before, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Genesis, and now he's applying it to the people as they're about to go into the land and live it out and flesh it out. He's giving a vision. He's addressing the nation. He's the creation of a nation in a speech. And for the centuries that follow, people resorted back to this speech to kind of see, are we on course? Are we staying faithful to that founding vision? This is a highly complex and very, very significant speech that we're looking at tonight. And of course, it ranges around all sorts of things. It's not a simple communication from A to B. It has got that direction, but it touches on all these various points. Now, what we're looking at tonight, this section that we're looking at tonight, he's saying things that are referring back to things he said before earlier in the speech. He's referring back to things that he said he's going, or actually referring forward to things he's intending to say. He's going back and referring to things in Israel's past. He's casting a vision about their future. And this is the kind of tipping point of the whole sermon. Chapter 17 is the tipping point of the sermon. Things are coming to a head, if I can put it like that. And here we are, and this is our practice, isn't it? It's our advantage or our disadvantage, the fact that we tend to take a slice out of a big piece of communication like that. And we're looking at a slice of it tonight. And I'm saying all those things because it is also, I just want to remind you, it's part of something much bigger, something much bigger. And here he starts talking, doesn't he, about justice. There will be the capacity for taking the idolater and putting them in court and administering justice and punishments. If they're murderers in the land, there will be courts. You'll be tried. There will be justice in the land. He's speaking about justice, and as he sort of stretches forward, he starts talking about the formation of a throne. There will be a king in the land. The supreme judge, if you will. There will be judges, there will be priests, there'll be courts, there'll be justice, and there will be a throne in the land. There will be a king who will be like the supreme justice in the land. There will be a supreme court, there'll be lower local courts. There will be justice in this land, in this society that he is speaking about. And he's already raised this little this subject in the passage we looked at last week. Do you remember the altar with the Ashtaroth pole next to it? Do you remember that? And he has this kind of this appalling vision that they've come all this way, and there is the possibility that having come into the land, instead of instituting the pure faith that they've received from Mount Sinai, this great revelation they've received from God, that they will get corrupted, and they will become a kind of like have a hybrid faith, a mixed faith. Has anybody reading recently about the services where they've been reading portions of the Quran out during the course of the service and stuff like that, Christian service? So we're kind of like losing that sense of distinctiveness. It's neither this nor that. And he's concerned that the nation could end up being neither this nor that. And if you look in verse 18 of chapter 16, just before, you see he's already told them you're going to set up these courts. There will be justices. There will be the sort of people that you can't buy, the people who won't pervert the course of justice. And they, what is their real supreme function, is to keep the faith pure. They're going to keep the faith pure. Now, if you're like me, as you read through the passage like this, as soon as we start talking about putting people to death, throwing stones and putting people to death, if you're feeling at all sleepy, if you're feeling a little bit like, oh, the reading's going on, suddenly you're kind of like, oh, it makes you sit up. And he's addressing thousands of people with all the thoughts and ideas and fidgeting going on around them and all the rest of it. And he's talking about the vision of the land. And suddenly he's saying to them, there's going to be justice in the land. And this reminder, this visceral reminder, in case anybody's drifting off here, if anybody's losing concentration here, if everybody doesn't think what I'm saying is important here, you need to know that when we get into the land and these courts and so on in place, they will have the power to put you to death. You will need to know. You need to listen to this, because life and death is in this substance, in this matter. These are not light things. You need to know this, because you need to know how to live. Now, it's quite clear this whole section about the king, which I'm just going to just say just the thing about, is that as it comes up here in the passage, I think the real point of it in the passage here, we will talk on Tuesday about Christ the King, and this of course is important to our understanding of Christ the King, but I think here what's the key thing is that this supreme justice, this supreme judge, the King, will be as subject to the law as everybody else. He's going to have to pay close attention to the law. He's going to have to know it inside out, not so he can just administer justice, because he needs to know that he is subject to exactly the same law as everybody else, the priests, the kings, the high, the low, everybody. One law, one God, and it's a matter of life and death. It's a matter of life and death. And I think if I'm anything like them, you've got my attention. You've got my attention. And when you think about these people who are there in the crowd, the people who have listened, the things that, you know, they have had, in a lot of ways, if I can put it like this, tough lives. Tough lives. They've been through an awful lot. And for people who are going through an awful lot, who've had a difficult life and have difficult lives, you want to get to a place where it stops, where you can relax, where you can cast off those cares. And in one sense, what they're being told here is that coming into the land, taking possession of the land, is not that time. Which in a way must be a hard lesson thing to hear. You know, they came from Egypt. And the Egyptians worked them to death. And because they were foreigners, and they didn't care about them, and they thought there were too many of them, they purposed to throw their children into the river and put them to death. They've been amongst people who didn't mind if they died. And were quite happy to kill them if needs be. Then they came out into the wilderness. And the wilderness beat down on them, a fierce sun, parched earth, hard rocks, mile upon mile of trackless waste, inhospitable, an environment which was basically, as human beings go, almost anywhere designed to destroy you as anywhere on earth. So there'd been a fight for survival in the wilderness. There'd been a fight for survival in Egypt. Now, standing between them, they're standing on one side of the River Jordan. They're being told to cross the River Jordan. And what's ahead of them is thousands and thousands of Canaanites armed to the teeth who they've got to go and fight. And they're not going to say, okay, come on in. They're going to try and kill you. They're going to kill you. Their whole life up until now has been a fight for survival. And ahead of them is a huge fight for survival. And when and if they should be so blessed to win, the sword is still going to hang over all of their lives. Because if they sin, they will die. Here's people who are living in the valley of the shadow of death all the time, all the time. In all of these situations of life, there is this fear of death. And by the grace of God, the Lord brought them out of Egypt. He brought them through the wilderness. They're learning to trust God, aren't they? The one who can save you and take you through the battles with the Canaanites and bring you out victorious. And in the end, the one who will be able to keep you from sin, keep you from punishment, keep you from the judgment, and so at last present you before his throne, accepted and beloved. But it's challenging. Can you see that? It's a challenging past, and is a challenging future for them all as well. And what's unique, I think, about what he's speaking to them about now, they're in fear of the judgment. He's putting them in fear of the judgment, isn't he? And what's unique about this is that some kinds of death are kind of like natural. One kind of just gets old or gets unwell and things proceed, or if you're lazy and you don't do anything and you don't farm your property and the winter comes and it gets cold and you haven't got any food, it's just a natural process of consequence. But this punishment is not natural. It's a direct and supernatural decree. God is commanding his agents, the courts, to take your life. Your enemy, if in that situation, if you rebel against God, is God. And you're not going to win. That is a battle you will never, ever win. So he's sharpening there. It certainly sharpens the mind, doesn't it? Here's a people who have been blessed and graced. The Lord said he will take them into the land. The Lord provided water in the wilderness. The Lord saved them from enemies too great for them in Egypt. And he is able to save them from judgment, isn't he? The same God who's brought them out, he's able to save them from the judgment. But they have to walk with him. They need to trust him. They need to find grace from him to live this kind of life. Because the danger is that if they relax, they come into the land, they relax, say, now I can do what I want. Now I can relax. I've done all those bits. I've survived all those things. Now I'm going to live how I want to live. No. While we're here on this earth, we have to trust God. We have to trust God. Otherwise, they're going to find themselves outside of this covenant community. There'll be no atonement. There's plenty of atonement, isn't there? In the commandments, there's plenty of atonement. If you've sinned, some small misdemeanor, you go to court, you've done X, Y, and Z, you have to make a sacrifice. The sacrifice covers. We're saying there are some things that if you do these things, the only blood that's going to be able to atone for your sin is your own. You'll be out. It's irrevocable. You will never return. This isn't exile. This is the end. So it's pretty serious stuff, isn't it? But there are real stringent controls put in place. So if this ultimate sanction of the law, if they're going into this environment, this ultimate sanction of the law is going to be in place, there is a great emphasis, isn't there, as you go in there, that these look in verse 4 there. If you hold, you shall inquire diligently to see if this thing is true and certain. You have to be absolutely certain. Now, I think in a one sense, he's talking to the judges now, isn't he? This isn't going to be some terrifying kind of state where there's willy-nilly law here, there, and people off with their head, off with their head. Diligent investigation, I suppose, you know, evidence, the police, journalists, people who are kind of looking into a situation, actually finding out what is going on here and making absolutely certain. There's the need of evidence, two witnesses, at least three more, preferably. These people have to be reliable people and not the sort of people who stand up in court and say, I think I saw this, or I kind of got the impression this was going on. Because if your evidence is used in this court of law, did you notice who's the person who has to pick up the first stone? It's going to be you. So you better be sure that what you're saying is right. You're under oath in that sense, aren't you? This is serious. So many of the things that we take for granted in our society, these things are based in these writings. The whole idea that, you know, we should have a proper trial, there should be evidence and a court who will listen, and the judges and the whole process here is very, 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 very stringent indeed. So the judgments need to be sure. Judgments have to be sure. And the first subject that comes up is this business of idolatry. If there's idolatry in the land, if there's so much of a rumor of idolatry in the land, if people start to depart from the Lord, if they're drifting away from God, if they've been gravitating to other gods and other things, no sooner as you hear of it, you have to get on to this. This has to be settled and sorted out immediately and thoroughly. Because their life depends on God. Their life depends on God. And if you reject God, if you start to go after other gods, then you're rejecting the law of God. You're rejecting the courts. You're rejecting the whole fabric of society. You're not part of this society, are you? You're not part of this. So where is there left for you to go? If you don't want to be part of this, you shouldn't be here. Leave. But to stay and to try and live like that in the face of God and his law and the courts and all the rest of it is just to invite death. If you reject life, you're inviting death. You're inviting death. You're bringing it on yourself. What's the court there to do? To uphold righteousness. There should be righteousness. The people will love each other. They'll look after each other. They're not going to kill each other and steal from each other and break up each other's relationships. They're going to sponsor life. There should be life. And when there's sin, make no mistake, the court's responsibility is to punish it. To punish sin. Now, obviously, when you... Punishment is a very complicated subject, isn't it? Because people nowadays, they say, well, the main thing is to try and protect society. That's why we deal with crimes, to protect society. Another argument that's made is, well, we want to try and reform the criminal. But it's very clear that those might be extra benefits. But the real thing is to punish sin and to uphold righteousness, to make it absolutely clear. This is right, this is wrong. That's what the court is there to do, to punish sin. And if it hasn't got absolute certainty, it's to do nothing at all. So that's its whole role. Its whole role is ultimately to administer punishments. So what happens when you get a situation where the courts don't do this, where this doesn't happen, and the law is not upheld? Well, the whole shape and character of the people will begin to collapse, won't it? People will start doing what's right in their own eyes, and the character and the shape of the community, the salt will lose its savour, won't it? The light will be hid under a bushel. It won't be clear. It will be a mixed message, and it will lose its shape. So this institution is extremely, extremely important. And you can see that in the future there's going to be lots and lots of trials, there's going to be lots and lots of tests.
And the courts are going to have to keep the line. Keep the line. The importance of these courts. Here in our country, I don't know if this is probably how important it is for me to say this really tonight, but you know, here in this country, we don't have a constitution, do we? We don't actually have a written constitution, so it's a bit different. In America, they do. They have a written constitution. People could appeal to something that's written down that says, this is my statutory right, and so on and so forth, and Obama can preach a sermon on the constitution. We can't do that. We can't do that because it's always developing and always changing all the time. That's why we started out with absolute monarchy, and now we've got a constitutional monarchy. We're developing. Our constitution is developing all the time. Israel's constitution is a supernatural law. The reason we allow for our constitution to change all the time is because we don't believe that our laws are divinely inspired. Do we? We believe they're right, and that's wrong. We believe this is what's appropriate for our society at this given time, and then later we may review it and change it all the time. There's no pretense that this is the will of God being made known that we have to abide by. But that's not true for Israel. This is the word of God. And so that it has a very different colour and aspect to it. But the church, the government of the church, if I can put it like that, is that a natural government? Is its government natural? Or is it, like Israel, a supernatural government? Do you believe that the commandments, the calls of God's people today are divine in origin? Do you believe that God governs the church through his word? Because that, in that sense, is our analogy with these people listening to the word. I've got way too much material here tonight. And so I'm going to just try and cut to the chase a little bit here. But I do believe that the church now, the difference between Israel then and the church now, is that we make no pretense to being a state. But the church still has to administer discipline, doesn't it? It still has to be discipline. What is, what is not. What's in, what is out. And that is what discipleship is all about. Learning what the Lord would have us do and living it. Living it out. And making those things clear. And what a wonderful thing it is when a person is brought to the Lord, comes to Christ, and comes into that community. And it's a joy, isn't it, as for the oversight of a church to be able to see that and check it out and look and search diligently and say, look, the Lord has added this person to the church. But it's equally the unhappy responsibility of people who have a responsibility of that nature in the life of the church when somebody is clearly drifting from the Lord, moving away from him, no longer speaking in ways that are comfortable and seeking, going after other things and becoming trapped in other things, that they also have to look into these things and see and be clear what is going on. That it's clear, this is the church. I don't know why. I have no idea why some people get so agitated. They're so angry with the church because the church believes things that they don't believe. As if somehow the church is imposing its beliefs on them. They can carry on living their lives. Why do you want to insist on trying to live that life that is uncomfortable to the truth in the church? In the church, why not just leave the church if that's how you want to live? Why do you want to get in the church and try and change the church and the constitution of the church? It can't work. Do you know what I'm referring to? You know the kind of thing I'm referring to? And there seems to be an ambition to somehow get the shape, the constitution, the government of the church to lose its edge and capacity to administer discipline. That the church should live according to God's laws and commandments and please him in the world, even if that runs against what's happening in the rest of the world. And in some countries, that will put you up against the authorities and will get you in a lot of trouble. In some countries, they may just think you're a bunch of fools. But that the church should be submitting to him. The church should be submitting to him.
and administering its own discipline, if I can put it like that. But with the same constraints, certainty, and diligence and seriousness. In fact, perhaps the more so. God seems, in this passage here, is demanding obedience from the judges, from the citizens, from the king. Everybody in the church has been, in Israel has been expected this level of obedience. When Jesus came, did he submit himself to being obedient to these things? Absolutely, and more than any other person that's ever lived. He alone has fully obeyed these things to the final and nth degree. Well, I think we need to too. We need to too. And when Paul says that if we would just judge ourselves, we won't be judged, isn't it better, isn't it, than rather than being disciplined, to discipline ourselves, to be familiar with, like those kings who had to copy the text out and familiarize themselves and make sure I am living. But wouldn't it be better if we were spending time in the Word, being familiar, saying, how do you want me to live, Lord? And seeing when we're not compliant to those things and dealing with those issues rather than getting to a situation where somebody has to step in and say, you know, I'm a bit concerned about the way things are going. Because then we won't be judged if we will just judge ourselves. And I don't know how similar and how different you think Israel in the Old Testament is to the church in the New Testament. But I'm saying that both are divinely constituted. They're both put together. Their constitutions are put together by God himself. They're both divine. But how radically different do you think they are? Do you think Israel is like this and the church is like that? Or do you think they are actually much more closely related to each other than that? I don't know what you think. But I would say that the whole thing, Old and New Testament, is one covenant. The covenant of grace. There's only one way to be saved. There's only one way to heaven. There always has been. There always will be only one way. In the Old Testament, they look forward to the coming of Christ, which was spoken to them in the prophets and in the sacrifices. All these things pointed forward to Christ. And if they saw him and believed in him, they would be saved. Now, and we look back at Christ to the finished work that he did. And if you believe in him, you will be saved. Could you save yourself by your works in the Old Testament? Could you overcome the Canaanites or deal with the Egyptians or walk through the wilderness or survive the ravages of the law by your own work? Of course not. All of grace. And I think it's true to say that the New Testament is all of grace too, isn't it? There's only one covenant. But it is administered in the Old Testament in a different way than it is administered in the New Testament. And the New Testament administration is so much more expedient and glorious than the Old Testament was. But in a sense, you could say that the New Testament is more severe. Because you could argue, what is worse, to say to somebody, this person is now going to be put to death, or to hand somebody over to Satan? Isn't that the extreme kind of sanction that you find in the New Testament, the handing over of one to Satan? Now, I think, you know, if I lost my life, but I kept my soul, if I knew I'd done wrong, I experienced the justice that I deserved, and I could at least in my own heart come to God and say, I know I've done wrong, and still possibly be saved even in the last hour, I think that's perhaps a less rigorous and awful thing than the idea that of just being handed over to Satan, though gloriously 2 Corinthians says that one could even come back from that, which is good news, isn't it? Isn't it good news?
because all these punishments ultimately do have the restoration of God's people, at least in view as well. But so why should there be a need to collapse the Old Testament and institute a New Testament? Why should that need to be? I suppose it's this. So Moses says this is the way it's going to be. But what happens if the kings become corrupt? What happens if it says here they should be one of your brothers? What if you get a situation where the king isn't even an Israelite? Certainly that was true in the time of Jesus, wasn't it? And the high priest. What if they're not even from the sons of Aaron anymore? They've just bought the tax rights from somebody else. What happens if all the institutions have become so corrupt? What if the people have become so corrupt? What if the law has been lost? What would happen when all the institutions themselves have collapsed and the nation itself has become corrupt? And the only person who's keeping the law is a carpenter from Nazareth. What will happen in a situation like that? When all those who should be upholding righteousness are now promoting unrighteousness. And all those who you'd expect perhaps to be those who would be in need of schooling and teaching are actually the only people who are living right before God. What's going to happen in a situation like that? When the law, which is to uphold righteousness, crucifies the only righteous person in the whole land. I think what happens at that moment, when utter corruption, when sin, when the sun is blotted out and all falls dark, then God himself, who's passed over all these things to men to administer, steps in himself to vindicate his word and his law and raises that person, the body of the Lord Jesus Christ, back from the dead and makes him king, priest, prophet, and Lord. And institutes all those things, all those offices, all those functions into him. Invests all those things into him and rebuilds and reconstitutes the whole nation and his people around him forever and ever and ever. A new testament, a new covenant in Jesus' name. I want to look at Jesus the King on Tuesdays. On this coming Tuesday, I want to sing something with you as we close, and if